We'll wait just a couple of minutes as people are entering into the webinar. We'll give it just another minute. Good afternoon. I'm Susan Margulies, and I lead the Engineering Directorate here at the National Science Foundation. And I am joined by our co-host, the leader of the SCIES Directorate, Greg Hager. And the two of us really want to welcome you warmly to the Alan T. Waterman first of our lecture series for this year. I'd like to introduce our Waterman awardee along with Greg, so we're going to tag team it today. Dr. Mayanat Baisi Bell is a biomedical engineer and a computer scientist. She's the director of the Photoacoustic and Ultrasonic Systems Engineering Laboratory at the Johns Hopkins University Whiting School of Engineering, where her pioneering research is transforming the utility of medical imaging in patient diagnostics and in treatments. This spring, Dr. Bell was recognized with this year's National Science Foundation Alan T. Waterman Award for her trailblazing interdisciplinary research that spans photoacoustic and ultrasound imaging, including advancements in coherence-based beamforming, photoacoustic guided surgery, and deep learning techniques that enhance medical imaging quality, reduce surgical complications, and foster more equitable healthcare practices. Dr. Bell's achievements cross several medical domains, including neurosurgery, cardiovascular health, women's health, cancer diagnosis, and treatment. She's the first Johns Hopkins winner in the award's 48-year history, and it's with pleasure that I turn over the introductory remarks to our Computer and Information Science and Engineering Assistant Director, Dr. Greg Hager, who is from Hopkins and who has known Dr. Bell for her entire career at Hopkins. Greg?
Great. Thank you, Susan. And let me add, it really is a pleasure and in fact an honor to welcome Baisi to this Alan T. Waterman lecture. Just a few more words about the work that Baisi has done. So she is particularly well known for her work in photoacoustic imaging, as Susan already mentioned. For those of you who don't know, we're very familiar with ultrasound as a modality where you inject sound and then you hear the echoes coming back, and we use that to form an image. But in photoacoustic image, instead of using sound, we use light, injecting energy via light and then hearing the response to that. And this is really a groundbreaking technology that is enabling many types of advances. BICI, Dr. Bell really pioneered the development of the first short-leg spatial coherence beamformer for ultrasound data, which revolutionized image clarity and reduced acoustic clutter that would otherwise confound diagnostic and interventional decisions. And she's particularly well known for her work in this area because she observed that as we use light, of course, skin tone affects the ability to inject energy into the body. And so she was able to address the challenge of skin tone bias in photoacoustic imaging, benefiting diverse communities. This invention also motivated the development of the generalized contrast to noise ratio. That's now a widely used metric that sets a new standard for image quality assessments. But it's not just in ultrasound itself that Dr. Bell has been a leader. She's also done work in the area of robotic surgery. She was the first to integrate photoacoustic imaging with the Da Vinci surgical robot, thus introducing a new suite of tools, particularly photoacoustic imaging, to that field. And she's also credited with being the first to introduce deep learning into the field of ultrasound and photoacoustic image formation, which has enabled new discoveries and new advances in that area. Before turning it over to BICI, I'm going to briefly close by just saying, as Susan noted, I've known Dr. Bell BICI for many years. And so I took the liberty of calling up a couple of her colleagues at Hopkins just to ask them what really stood out in her career. They all kind of uniformly said the following, which is she is somebody who is astoundingly good at picking the right problem in the areas that she works in. She's incredibly dedicated, she's focused, and she really drives to find the right solution. But they also said, and I think this is just an important, she cares about people. She's interested in broadening participation, mentoring, and bringing new investigators into the field as well. And that is at least a large part of her legacy in addition to her research contributions. And so it really is an honor to be able to introduce you today, BICI. And I'm going to turn it over to you to deliver your Alan T. Waterman Award lecture.
Thank you so much, Greg and Susan, for the kind words, the comprehensive introduction, and even the surprise to hear from my colleagues at Hopkins. That was a really nice touch. Thank you. So I am going to share my screen and get started with talking to you about equitable medical imaging. So I imagine that now everyone should be able to see what I'm projecting. And I'm honored really to be here today to talk about equitable medical imaging. And as we know, the healthcare system is intended to serve a broad variety of patients. These patients often seek medical care in the form of visiting hospitals and clinics where labs and tests are run, and medical imaging may be required to produce diagnostic reports followed by treatment plans. In fact, as part of both the diagnostic and interventional procedures, medical imaging may be utilized. And there are different types of medical imaging, with four of the most common being X-ray, X-ray CT or computed tomography, ultrasound, and MRI, which stands for magnetic resonance imaging. Now, ultrasound is one of the more standard approaches and has benefits such as being portable, so it can be carried anywhere, even in the most remote locations. It provides information on the spot in real time, and it's not as costly as some of the other options. So these are some of the reasons that attracted me to the area of ultrasound imaging. And at the time, I had this impression that ultrasound was a one-size-fits-all type of technology. But after becoming a researcher in this space, I quickly learned that this is not the case due to the poor quality of ultrasound images obtained with a subset of patients. To understand why this occurs, let's dig a little deeper into the ultrasound imaging process. You may be familiar with the look of an ultrasound machine, which has three main components: the scanner, which houses much of the electrical and computing hardware of the system, the ultrasound probe itself, which contains an array of different shapes and sizes and could be used to interface with the body to create an image, and then a monitor that displays that image on a screen. The way that these three components interact is that the scanner transmits electrical pulses to the ultrasound probe, which contains elements that convert these voltage traces into mechanical pressure waves that propagate as sound into the body. And then the sound is reflected off of different structures and returned to the ultrasound probe, which senses that sound and converts the sound back to electrical signals or voltage traces that are sent to an onboard computer for processing. And the first step in the processing chain is a beamforming step. This is a very critical step and can be considered as the first line of software defense against a poor quality image. It is also the focus of much of my research. After beamforming, signals may undergo some additional post-processing, and then finally, the image is ready for display on the monitor. Now, as mentioned in the introduction, when we combine ultrasound with light, which can be delivered through a laser, we get a photoacoustic imaging system. And so if we want to image a target with this system, we transmit light to the target, which absorbs the light, undergoes thermal expansion, and generates a sound wave that can be detected with conventional ultrasound technology. And so the process from here is very similar, where the ultrasound probe contains elements that convert the pressure waves into electrical signals that are sent to the scanner, which has an onboard computer for processing. Again, we see this very critical beamforming step. And then after beamforming, there's some more post-processing before the image is ready for display. Now, ultrasound and photoacoustic images, as you can see, are very complementary because they share many of the same software and hardware components. And so the two imaging methods can be integrated to improve the overall healthcare and medical imaging experience. The reason we might want to integrate photoacoustic imaging with these existing medical imaging techniques, not just ultrasound, but really any one of these techniques, is because it exploits a different tissue property, and that is the property of optical absorption. So it relies on the absorption of light and is beneficial for targeting any structure that may have a higher optical absorption than its surroundings. This is true of blood vessels, as well as metal implants that may be inserted into the body and contrast agents that may be injected into the body. So we can appreciate that photoacoustic imaging has the potential to provide new information for diagnostic, surgical, and interventional applications. It also shares many of the same benefits that attracted me to the field of ultrasound imaging in the first place. With this backdrop, we can now appreciate that my lab focuses on this cycle of innovation, where we develop ultrasound and photoacoustic imaging systems using theories, models, and simulations that we develop, like the one shown here, to design novel beamformers that can be interchangeable between ultrasound and photoacoustic imaging systems. We also design imaging probes that are catered to specific procedures, such as this side-firing light delivery system for diagnosing and treating prostate cancer. Our designs are then used to build and test prototypes that will ultimately improve ultrasound and photoacoustic image quality. And then we can integrate our designs and prototypes with commercially available hardware, such as the ultrasound hardware, a laser, or a robot, together creating a new system that's the first of its kind to be tested on patients. This research is really exciting to me because it allows us to consider all possible patients in our designs, especially in cases where existing designs do not do so. Then we might learn something from our clinical studies that would require us to develop patient-specific theories, models, and simulations, and the cycle of innovation continues from there. Throughout this presentation, I will show you examples of the benefits of a significant innovation in beamformer design. So let's review some beamforming basics. We already understand that whether sound or light is transmitted, the light can be absorbed and the sound can be reflected. And in both cases, sound propagates to an ultrasound probe. Now, the time it takes for signals from a target, such as this point target shown here, the time it takes for these signals to be recorded by the sensors in the ultrasound probe is related to the distance between each sensor and the target. So we might get voltage traces that look like this. Therefore, we apply system time delays to align all the signals that came from the same location. And then we can sum across channels to get one large high amplitude signal associated with that location. This is the process of the amplitude-based delay and sum beamforming that's used in ultrasound systems around the world. This process could be repeated for multiple locations or multiple lines or beams in our image. Now, if I have a body part that produces a lot of scattering, I might get a random recording on one of a subset of the elements. This recording persists after time delays and after signal summation. And you can see how this random recording has a similar amplitude to the actual signal of interest. So it could confuse a diagnostic or interventional decision. And this is what we call acoustic clutter. This acoustic clutter does not exist in the ideal model of the delay in some beamforming process that's used around the world, resulting in technology failing patients who produce more acoustic clutter than others. To address this challenge, we can replace the summation operator with a cross-correlation operator. And that's because signals that are similar to each other will have a high spatial coherence. So all of the signals associated with the actual target will be highly spatially correlated, whereas signals correlated with this random recording will be low in comparison to its neighbor. So it'll have a low spatial coherence. And this is the concept of the coherence-based beamforming method that I initially invented as a graduate student for diagnostic ultrasound imaging. And then I showed its benefits for photoacoustic imaging as a postdoc, initially for interventional image-guided cases. For the remainder of this talk, I'll speak on applications of coherence-based beamforming to make diagnostic imaging, surgery, and image-guided interventions more equitable. I'll then talk about the computational effort involved in the design of this beamformer, and I'll end with a summary and outlook. A few example diagnostic images are shown on this slide, starting with cardiac images, where we see that due to a lot of sound scattering in the chest wall, we have acoustic clutter that overwrites this beating heart signal of interest in the amplitude-based image. When we process the same heart signals with a coherence-based beamformer, we can see the borders of this beating heart much more clearly, which is really important for getting the right cardiovascular health assessment. This improved image quality with the coherence-based beamformer is particularly promising for patients who are overweight and obese and tend to generate more acoustic scattering and therefore acoustic clutter. More recently, my lab has showed that the same concept applies to breast imaging, where if we want to distinguish this fluid from a solid mass, which appears similarly dark in amplitude-based images, we can instead take a coherence-based imaging approach because fluid masses have a lower spatial coherence than the surrounding tissue, whereas solid masses have a similar spatial coherence to surrounding tissue. So we can use this feature to distinguish a fluid mass, which is typically benign and doesn't cause any problems, versus a solid mass, which would need to be recommended for a biopsy. So we get the case that if we can't distinguish it, we have patients unnecessarily receiving biopsies and other invasive procedures, and sometimes waiting up to 2 years for a final diagnosis. So this coherence-based technology is particularly promising for women with dense breasts who tend to generate more acoustic clutter and also represent a patient population who are underserved with respect to non-invasive methods to detect breast cancer. Not only can we get improvements in cardiac and breast imaging, but my colleagues have shown similar benefits in liver imaging, where we could see the vessels in this liver more clearly, which has implications for diagnosing fatty liver disease. It also has implications for maternal and fetal health, where we could see fetal structures more clearly, such as this nose, mouth, and the little fetal heart. And similarly, we could see very small vessels, such as these arterioles surrounding a major carotid artery, which is again important for cardiovascular health assessment. Now, as mentioned earlier, the name of this coherence-based beamforming method is the SLSC beamformer, which stands for short lag spatial coherence. And the SLSC beamformer is not only useful for ultrasound imaging, but also for photoacoustic imaging, which suffers from something that all optics-based technologies suffer from, and that is poor optical penetration depth in the presence of highly melanated skin. And when we have highly melanated skin, melanin acts as an optical absorber, and so it generates a photoacoustic effect that at the skin layer that propagates both forward and backward. The backward propagation tends to give us a very high amplitude signal in the amplitude-based photoacoustic images at the skin layer, as you see here for this darker skin tone. It's that forward propagation, however, that tends to be even more problematic, because as sound propagates forward, it generates all of the scattering that we now know causes a lot of acoustic clutter and therefore overwrites the actual signals of interest in the body. When we instead take the SLSC approach to imaging, we can see that regardless of skin tone, we can see the structures within the body more clearly. And so while the amplitude-based approach leads to an inherent skin tone bias, the coherence-based approach could address this bias by reducing clutter, which is particularly beneficial for patients with darker skin tones. Now, these examples come from the forearm of volunteers, but the same concept can be applied to the emerging area of photoacoustic breast imaging, starting with simulations, where we could take realistically previously validated models of breast tissue, such as the one shown here, which has these multiple components, and we can model the acoustic properties such as sound, speed, and attenuation. We can also model optical properties such as the skin absorption as a function of skin tone on this x-axis and as a function of wavelength, which we see examples of for these different colors. We could use this information to model absorbed energy density, and then we can get images of multiple virtual patients, which you see here for photoacoustic breast imaging cases. From top to bottom, we see what happens for different skin tones, and from left to right, we see what happens as the wavelength increases. There are three takeaway features that I want to leave you with based on this image. The first is that if we focus on the lowest wavelength with our target of interest shown in yellow here from the preceding slide, you can appreciate that it's increasingly difficult to visualize the photoacoustic target as skin tone darkens. Second, with some wavelengths, such as this 810 nanometer wavelength, we could see our photoacoustic target much more clearly, but the poor visibility at darker skin tones still persists. And then third, with higher wavelengths, such as 1064 nanometers, we have a lower skin absorption and greater water absorption. So there's water in this model before it reaches the breast tissue model. And so with this trade-off with a higher water absorption at this wavelength, we see that the target appears with similar amplitude regardless of skin tone. These three takeaway points are for a realistic breast model. Finally, because this is a simulation of virtual patients, we can do things that would not happen in real life, like remove the skin completely. And when we do this, we get even better appearance of this target when we compare to even the very light skin tone on the very top row. Therefore, based on this one simulation study that my lab published, we have additional evidence to conclude that skin is indeed primarily responsible for the presence of acoustic clutter in breast imaging, regardless of skin tone or wavelength. To achieve photoacoustic breast imaging, one common design is to suspend the breast in a water-filled cup-like device with lasers and acoustic sensors located at fixed and known distances from each other. So we can appreciate how darker skin tones are expected to suffer with this design. Other common designs and applications that similarly suffer are featured here. To achieve superficial vessel imaging of any body part, as illustrated with the palm of this person's hand, the probe can be sandwiched by laser light plates. And this design was also used in this molecular imaging case where we could see the uptake of a contrast agent over time, and that contrast agent could potentially be bound to a drug to determine drug delivery properties. The ultrasound probe can also come in the form of a very small catheter that's inserted into a vessel lumen and attached to an optical fiber, delivering light to determine the presence of plaque in a vessel, which of course is important for diagnoses of cardiovascular health disease like atherosclerosis. Given this backdrop, my lab has been at the forefront of pioneering novel designs and applications in the area of photoacoustic guided surgery, which do not require light penetration through the skin. With our approach, we break the rigidity in conventional system designs and add more flexibility by separating the light source from the acoustic receiver and instead attaching light sources to surgical tools. One reason we do this is because metal has a high optical absorption, and so it affords us the opportunity to see both a tool tip and the vasculature hidden by tissue during surgery. This information is useful to provide surgeons with the level of detail they need to avoid accidental injury to major blood vessels during surgery, which can be very catastrophic and could potentially lead to patient death. The first working prototype for this design and concept was demonstrated by my lab for neurosurgery, where we built a specialized light delivery system that you see me holding here. It surrounds a neurosurgical drill. We then have this mock surgical environment where these two black lines represent two internal carotid arteries that we don't want to injure. When our prototype enters the mock surgical field, we see the tooltip and its relationship to the mock arteries in the accompanying photoacoustic image. This result gives us the confidence to correlate what we see in the photoacoustic image with what is actually taking place in the surgical field. But in a real surgical environment, the structures are hidden to the naked eye. So we added a layer of bone to increase the computational complexity of the mock surgical field. And in doing this, we see that the same information is present. That information is that it's safe to proceed when we only see the drill tip in the photoacoustic image. Otherwise, we don't want to proceed, or we proceed with caution when we see that the drill tip is located next to one of these major vessels. We can also use simulation software that tells us details about the light profile sizes and optimal placement of the optical fiber relative to tool shafts and relative to distances from the tissue surface. Then we can take photographs to confirm that the dimensions and the shapes are as expected, which is what we see an example here in one case where the tool is close to the surface and farther away. It matches very well with what the simulation on the left would predict. On the acoustic side of things, we can perform patient-specific simulations to determine the optimal acoustic receiver locations. With this highly customizable approach, we identified three possible locations based on a series of simulations and experiments performed with the same cadaver skull, which you see a 3D representation of over here. Now you're seeing the result of an acoustic K-wave simulation of a photoacoustic source placed within the location of the internal carotid artery. Each dot that you see represents the location of external sensors that were distributed around the skull. And the color that you see represents the maximum pressure received by each sensor. This one result shows us three possible ultrasound probe placements based on the location of maximum pressure. Those locations are the eyes, the nose, and somewhat over here is the temporal region, which is the thinnest portion of our skull. We validated these simulation results with the experimental setup shown here using the same cadaver skull that was simulated. The commonality among these setups is that we have an optical fiber in the nose to illuminate the location of the internal carotid arteries, which is also the location at which the minimally invasive neurosurgery would be performed. And then we have a probe placed on the locations identified by our simulations. This image shows the probe on the temporal region. This image shows the probe in the nose. And this image shows, the bottom row shows the probe on the eye ocular region, both in the absence and presence of eyeballs that we inserted into the skull. So from this experimental setup, we obtained the images that you now see where the photoacoustic images are shown in color, overlaid on grayscale CT images. The locations of the photoacoustic signals match very well with the locations of the left and right internal carotid arteries. And although the amplitudes differ between the eye and the temporal region, as again shown by this color bar, we can see in the photoacoustic images similar intensity, and that is because we used the coherence-based approach to photoacoustic imaging to display these signals. And this beamformer ignores the amplitudes in order to maximize what we see when we're guiding surgeries. So overall, the combination of simulations and experiments highlights a new possibility of performing patient-specific simulations to determine optimal probe placement prior to the initiation of a surgery. And we can couple that with coherence-based beamforming to further maximize image quality. Although we started this field with a minimally invasive neurosurgery concept, this slide summarizes the wide range of possible applications for guidance of surgeries and procedures with photoacoustic imaging. I'll focus the next few examples on our hysterectomy approach, our robotic approach, and this cardiac application, and I refer you to any one of these other publications listed here for the remaining for details about the remaining approaches. And this perspective article that I published in the Journal of Applied Physics in 2020 is also a good resource if you desire to learn more. So let's focus on the application of robotic surgeries, such as surgeries performed with the Da Vinci robot, where the surgeon would sit at a master console and the subtle motion of the surgeon's hands translate to motions of the robot arms, which are holding surgical tools that are inserted through keyhole-like incisions into the patient. Our goal is to bring in a miniaturized photoacoustic imaging system to perform photoacoustic guided surgery by attaching specialized light delivery systems to any one of the Da Vinci tools. Here is an example of what the surgeon sees when looking through the master console and sweeping the surgical tool around the surgical space to identify where to make an incision. The inset shows the corresponding photoacoustic images. And from this example, we see that there are photoacoustic signals in one region and no photoacoustic signals when the surgeon moves away from that region. Now, we developed this concept for guidance of hysterectomies, which is one of the most commonly performed procedures with the Da Vinci robot. This procedure is performed with the idea that we want to remove the uterus, and to do that, we need to sever the uterine arteries, which are shown in red, while keeping the ureter, which is shown in yellow, intact in order to preserve urinary function. One challenge with this procedure is accidental injury to the ureters, given their close proximity to the uterine arteries, and we are exploring photoacoustic image guidance to overcome this challenge. We are also working on mapping the information provided by photoacoustic imaging to an auditory output as requested by one of my gynecological surgeon collaborators. And I'll show you an example of that on the next slide, but if you have an aversion to somewhat gory images, you might want to turn your head. So, and that's because the demonstration was provided with a human cadaver, where this ureter that you see is filled with contrast agent methylene blue. And here we have the tooltip, which is made of metal and can be seen in the photoacoustic image along with the ureter to get photoacoustic images like the one you saw on the previous slide. And then we can measure tool-to-ureter distances and map that distance to a sound. And I'll play a video that shows the example of what I mean by this. So you can see that when the distance measurement is below a certain threshold, that is the only time that a surgeon would be alerted. And this allows the surgeon to not only look at images, but also listen to determine proximity to a major vessels. So this leaves us with a wide range of possibilities, from visual to auditory cues, to deliver information to surgeons once we generate proximity information based on the photoacoustic data. The process required to separate two or more photoacoustic sources from each other to deliver that proximity information is called spectral unmixing. And this process is typically performed with multiple wavelengths, which produce different photoacoustic responses. However, in real time during surgeries, it is not feasible to wait for a laser to transition through all possible wavelengths. So my lab developed an acoustic-based approach to spectral unmixing that only requires two wavelengths. To implement this approach, first, for each wavelength, we acquire the radio frequency ultrasound data, and then we want to isolate meaningful signals from the surrounding background. And we do that using a coherence-based approach, specifically the locally weighted short lag spatial coherence beamformer. This beamformer removes incoherent noise, enabling segmentation of signals of interest. And in this case, the signals of interest are methylene blue and blood before we know which one is which. We then apply a series of steps such as IQ demodulation, stacking of the spectra, principal component analysis, and compare that to an atlas that we've previously built, and then we have all the information we need to classify which signal is which. Here are some results from the classification where the X and Y axes show the wavelengths tested with our dual wavelength approach, and the color bar reports the accuracy for each wavelength pair. The result of our approach was compared to five more common methods, A through E on the left here. We see that with multiple combinations of only two wavelengths, were able to achieve similar accuracy to approaches A and B, which required 12 wavelengths. And we also have better accuracy than approaches C, D, and E. Now, this is really exciting for customizing how we can treat patients during surgeries to avoid accidental injury. And we can also appreciate the benefits of the coherence-based beamformer to segment signals of interest from surrounding noise and clutter to achieve this result. This approach is not only promising for surgical guidance, but for really any minimally invasive image-guided intervention. For example, needle biopsies or cardiac catheter placements are two approaches that can benefit. Starting with our core photoacoustic imaging system that you see here, we can attach our ultrasound probe to a robot arm, and the light source can be inserted into a cardiac catheter to create what we call a photoacoustic visual servoing system. This system allows automatic tracking, following, and centering of interventional tooltips, such as a cardiac catheter tip, which would appear in the photoacoustic image. Here's a demonstration of the system in action on a live in vivo animal model, where the user, who is me in this video, is inserting the optical fiber catheter pier, and you can see the robot held probe moving from the chest to the heart as it follows this motion. And the photoacoustic image displayed in the background here shows us what the signal looks like and how it's maintaining visualization because of the automated process that we see here. Now, our goal is to use this to make it to the heart, and we successfully accomplished our goal as shown on this slide. These cardiac catheter tips that we are tracking with photoacoustic imaging and a robot are currently tracked by live X-ray movies called fluoroscopy, with an example image shown on the top and bottom here. Well, we have the challenge with fluoroscopy that it does not provide depth information. Ultrasound, on the other hand, as shown in the middle, can show us how deep the catheter is located from the body surface, but it also has a failure point because the catheter tip can blend into the background when it touches tissue. When we instead insert the optical fiber into the hollow core of the cardiac catheter, we get this very exciting result on the right, showing that we can see the cardiac catheter tip in the photoacoustic image, regardless of tissue contact. This result is also promising and exciting because it does not require ionizing radiation, which is used in fluoroscopy and can be harmful to patients, clinicians, and operators with repeated significant usage. So this result implies that we can potentially use photoacoustic imaging to completely replace fluoroscopy. And my vision to replace fluoroscopy is to have a system that is as unobtrusive as possible. So we want wireless ultrasound probes attached to body-mounted robots, and we would use miniaturized laser systems to deliver the light with this technology. One challenge with the miniaturized laser systems, though, is that they have low energies, which translates to low signal amplitudes. So here we run into another problem with the amplitude-based approach to signal processing, as naturally the signals would be lower in amplitude with that signal processing approach. So with this again being our imaging setup, where we have the optical fiber in the heart sending light and an ultrasound probe placed externally to receive the sound, my lab has shown that we can overcome the challenge of low laser energies by taking a coherence-based approach rather than an amplitude-based approach, which you can see the benefits of the coherence-based approach to track this cardiac catheter tip on the right in direct comparison to the amplitude-based approach created with the same images on the left. So this leads us to conclude that tracking cardiac catheter tips with low laser energies is possible with coherence-based beamforming, and it also supports the broader vision of replacing fluoroscopy. We are now looking to apply this concept to the emerging area of flexible array technology, which allows us to conform to different body shapes and sizes for wearable health applications. This extreme flexibility introduces the engineering challenge of unknown array shapes, and we can appreciate the severity of this challenge by looking at how these two signals appear very differently when the array shape is correct versus incorrect. A possible solution is to make guesses of array shapes calculate the spatial coherence associated with the guess, find where spatial coherence is maximized as an indicator of the associated array shape, and then use that to beamform images. So maximizing a coherence metric makes array shape estimation possible with these modern state-of-the-art flexible array technologies. And this approach allows us to make real-time images, such as the first image with a flexible array created in my lab shown here. We are imaging a tooltip facilitated by attaching an optical fiber, this time to a needle, as shown in this example image there. On the topic of real-time imaging, which I motivated with needle imaging, catheter imaging, surgical guidance, breast cancer detection, and cardiovascular health assessments, I want to give you an appreciation of the different computations involved to achieve this more equitable approach of coherence-based imaging. Here is a representation of the signals received by many transducer elements. I would first need to delay the signals in time to account for the time of arrival differences that we talked about earlier. And then I could, for each location, window the data and calculate the cross correlations, which would give me this normalized spatial coherence function. And then I would integrate that spatial coherence function to get one pixel in the image. And I repeat this process for multiple depths and multiple locations to the left and right of the one depth that I've shown and illustrated here. And I directly contrast that with the delay and sum approach, which I simply just have to delay the signals and then sum, and I get my final image. So if I list out all of the computational steps involved, we can appreciate that the correlation calculation step is the most computationally expensive in terms of its difference between this and the more conventional approach. To speed this up, my lab has introduced CoherNet, which is a deep neural network or a deep learning approach to creating these spatial coherence functions. We believe we are learning from the physics of wave propagation by giving the network thousands to millions of training examples to understand what different spatial coherence functions could potentially look like, therefore bypassing the multiple computational steps required and giving us two possible pathways. One is the original pathway that produces an image that looks like this, and the second is the pathway that uses CoherNet that would give us images that look like this. We see that there is a great similarity between these two pathways to the extent that we have a 0.93 image-to-image correlation over the entire test set. And we achieved our goal of speeding up the process of delivering the data needed for the SLSC beamformer. And to dive a little deeper into the coherence functions that are generated with the two pathways, in dark blue, you see the original pathway, and in the lighter blue, you see what the deep neural network produces. And you can see that there's great similarity between these two types of methods for calculating coherence functions. And we see slightly better performance in the shorter spatial lag region. And that is by design of the beamforming process, or the deep learning process in this case for the beamformer, where we penalize errors in the short lag region more than errors in greater lags. And that's because we're integrating over the short lag region, and that's the information that we're using to make the image. And you can see how we apply a weighting function in our loss function to account for this in our design process. This applies to photoacoustic data as well, where the blue shows the calculated coherence function and the red shows the DNN approach, with the input this time being photoacoustic rather than ultrasound data. And then we can use the outputs that you see here to create SLSC photoacoustic images, which are beneficial for reducing clutter and addressing skin tone bias that is present in traditional amplitude-based images, which again, I'm replicating on this slide, same images that you saw earlier. One other highlight of the deep neural network approach is that because you see these coherence functions with the deep neural network tend to be smoother than what the calculated approach produces, we also smooth out and reduce more of the acoustic clutter with a deep neural network approach. As you see when comparing these images, they look a little cleaner than the calculated approach. So it has an additional benefit when we take this learning approach. In conclusion, I've shown you how coherence-based techniques enable more equitable ultrasound and photoacoustic imaging. I've shown you applications that range from diagnostic imaging to surgery and minimally invasive interventions. And I've also shown you how we can have patient-specific hardware and software innovations to fuel this advancement. On the software side, we can simulate virtual patients. On the hardware side, we can develop novel hardware to cater to different variations in patients too. More broadly, I've shown you that diversity drives innovation. Not only diversity of thought, but also diversity of the data sets. If we're claiming to improve image quality, we want to make sure that we have multiple possible patients that exist in the healthcare system represented in our data sets. So this includes multiple body shapes and weights. We want to make sure that we are accounting for the dense breast that could exist, as well as the dark skin tones that exist. And this dovetails nicely with the importance of diversity with respect to deep learning and the need to consider everyone in training data sets and throughout the entire training process. This extends to diversity of the personnel working on the problems, as represented here by the distribution of my 13 current and incoming PhD students who come from different departments. It's this diversity of thought that allows us to ask diversity of questions, and it's this diversity that really determines the type of science that's being done. And each person has a unique background, not only in terms of scientific questions, but also in terms of a skill level, as represented here for my background in terms of degrees that I've had or departments that I've been affiliated with over the course of my career. To further support diversity and equity in medical imaging, my lab has led efforts to make publicly available ultrasound and photoacoustic imaging resources, such as making the coherence-based beamformer for ultrasound imaging available for research use through the ultrasound toolbox. We also provide FocoSpace to understand the theory of translating from ultrasound to photoacoustic coherence-based beamforming, as there are subtle nuanced differences. We also provide data to train neural networks to accomplish imaging tasks, such as detecting COVID-19 in applications that use wireless ultrasound probe with smartphone monitors to really deploy this approach in very remote locations. And we've, along these lines, created a challenge for our entire community working at the intersection of ultrasound beamforming and deep learning in order for the community to have a common database of code, data, and top performing solutions. And so I was the lead organizer of this challenge, and it's really great to see how this has really enabled the creation of new types of techniques, making data more available for others to build on existing results, and thereby lowering the barrier for entry into an otherwise very highly specialized field. And this makes the community more inclusive and equitable from this perspective as well. On the topic of photoacoustic guided surgery, the ideas have been broadly disseminated to the public and featured in multiple technical and media news outlets as shown here. It's also been the source of a considerable and generous amount of early career funding opportunities to my lab. One of these opportunities led to the creation of this video on YouTube, which I invite you to check out to see some of our technology in action. Also check out this invited review article that I co-authored with my graduate student at the time, who is now an assistant professor. This review covers multiple aspects of photoacoustic imaging to guide surgical and related non-surgical interventions, including a discussion of complete systems and tools needed to maximize success. Finally, the concept of equity in medical imaging extends more broadly to the need for equity in the entire field of biomedical engineering and beyond. It is exciting that the field of biotechnology and biophotonics is placing emphasis on this importance, as evidenced through these upcoming special issues in academic journals. I am aware of two recent calls for papers, first as a member of the editorial board for Gen Biotechnology, which has already started publishing the early access articles highlighted on the left. And the second opportunity is one I am guest editing on the topic of skin tone bias and biophotonics. Submissions for this opportunity are currently being accepted through November 15th of this year. As I close, I must thank my dedicated team of students, postdocs, and collaborators who have helped to make A lot of the work that I presented possible over the years and are still pushing the boundaries forward with me even now. I thank my graduate advisors and mentors who started me on this path, two of which are named at the bottom of this slide, but there are so many more that I want to thank for help and support along the way. And I also thank my funding sources for supporting this work. To put a few faces with some of the names that you see, here is a recent picture of my team. Visit the Pulse Lab website for more details, and thank you all for your attention. I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Baisi, for just an incredible lecture. I have to admit, as I was going along, I was thinking of questions, and every time I had a question, you answered it. So it's just a talk that way. I'll tell all of our participants, we do have a Q&A panel that you should be able to see in your Zoom session, and you can post your questions there, and we will relay them in the order they're received. So let me start with the first question. This comes from Jessalyn Dunn, and she is interested in hearing more about the trade-offs between the deep neural network, SLSC, and other methods that lead to smooth signals versus the original SLSC in terms of removing acoustic clutter and being able to visualize small but important structures.
Yes. So of course, you know, if we wanted to not even take a deep neural network approach, we could say, let's try some type of smoothing filter to see if we can smooth out the signals. But even if we were to take that approach, it doesn't address the heart of the issue, which led to the deep neural network approach. And that is computations for correlation calculations are very expensive. And that expense comes in the form of slowing down the real-time nature, so the ability to make decisions on the spot based on the images that you see. So if you don't carefully design something that is less computationally expensive, then you end up not utilizing one of the main benefits of the ultrasound or photoacoustic imaging system process, which is that you can provide information in real time. So I would say that that is one of the biggest trade-offs there and the reason that we explored the deep neural network approach. We also, when applied to ultrasound, we've shown that although, you know, there are GPU advances that could be used as well, there are some shortcuts that are required in order to even implement the computationally expensive beamformers on GPUs to speed up the process that way. And when we take a deep neural network approach, because we're learning directly from the data and based on the physics, we're not taking any shortcuts, we're able to preserve the original function better than we would when we try to take some shortcuts required to put the beamformer on graphical processing units. So those are some of the trade-offs.
I have another question from Jonathan Pittman, who is interested. You've inspired Jonathan to re-enter the field. So he received his bachelor's degree in computer engineering in 2018, has a few years in industry, and really is energized about the idea of a career path in medical imaging and signal processing and wants to do research in this area, especially on reducing racial and gender disparities. So do you have advice for someone who's already out of school about how to get that research experience and whether you're suggesting returning to a research in a lab, or is industry doing this as well? So just a little bit about that, and then know that we probably have six other questions.
Sure. So I think research and innovation can happen in a lot of different spaces. So the key is really to identify which space do you want to be in when you are making those innovations. I mean, it could happen in an academic setting. It could also happen in a research and development setting and government labs as well. And so once you identify where you would like to make that impact, then the next step would be to identify institutions and people who could help you toward that end goal.
Hey, thank you.
All right, I'll take the next questions from an anonymous attendee. And the question is very broad, so you can decide where you want to go with this. How do you envision the role of AI in bioimaging?
Okay. I think, you know, we have to really be careful because while there are a lot of different benefits with AI, one of which I've shown, there can also be some detrimental effects if we don't consider multiple possible patients, for example, in our designs, we end up replicating the biases that already exist in current technology. And so we want to, if we go that path, make sure we're taking a truly inclusive approach to the design of these artificial intelligence solutions.
Okay. So we have a couple of people who are asking whether it's implemented beyond animal models and in patients. So what is your...
Absolutely. So the first few examples that I showed were human patients, the cardiac example were patients who were treated at the Duke Medical Center. The breast imaging examples were patients who were treated at Johns Hopkins University. And this is actually an ongoing study that we have where we are still evaluating the benefits for even some more of our recent innovations. And then, you know, the photoacoustic technology, on the other hand, while some of the more invasive approaches were limited to animal models, the example for skin tones, that was a collaboration with colleagues in Brazil who had volunteers, human volunteers that were imaged, and we collaborated to apply the technique that I developed to those human images.
Great, thank you. So the next question comes from Sandeep Gupta. Thank you for your comprehensive talk. But he asked if you could elaborate on the personalization challenges from a scalability and complexity perspective.
So I'm going to take that to mean the personalization if we're doing simulations, because I did talk about that type of personalization a lot. And of course, you know, these acoustic simulations can take hours or sometimes days to run. And so in terms of scalability, and if you're trying to like have a decision to make a treatment decision about a patient on the spot, it might not be the best way to make use of those more highly complex simulations, but maybe if there's a way to simplify it by removing some of the complexity that gives us very realistic results, but yet still good enough to make a decision, that might be one way to scale to multiple patients if you need a decision more rapidly than what we do with our approaches, where we're really interested in sticking as close to the as possible to the physics. And so we can afford to wait a few days if we want a solution.
I think related that is understanding margin of error. And what challenges do you face in incorporating deep learning in the computation technology? And when you're talking about patient specific, that sort of gets you into a margin of error as well.
Yeah, so I guess when you are looking at, I guess, back to the deep learning solution, and you're looking at these different patients, it certainly, I believe, reduces the margin of error if you're trying to cater your design to one patient. I think the problem that we see with the historical technology is we're trying to come up with one number to describe the entire population, one speed of sound, for example, one density, one attenuation value. And in the past, you know, there were different approaches to get that one value, maybe take the average, but that average leaves out the people on the fringes of the average. And so when you now take a patient-specific approach, you are catering your model to that patient. That patient is not left out. And if you do that for every patient, you definitely will reduce the margin of error.
So the next question comes from an anonymous attendee. And the question is, how do you expect this powerful message of diversity driving innovation to impact other kinds of medical research and applications?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I think, you know, once we start to realize the importance, some are at different path steps along the path than others. But I think once more of us realize the importance of diversity in the broader scheme of things, we will have this, you know, more ideas, more innovation, more mixing and merging of things that were never thought of before, to further improve the impact that we can have as a society.
Great, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up with one last question. And that's more philosophical. Was there insight at a particular moment that really marked as a turning point for you in your research?
Well, I think I had a lot of these insights and turning points. I think, you know, so if we talk about from the very beginning when I entered the ultrasound field, I actually entered the field for a very different reason. I wanted to develop technology for cancer detection that used my mechanical engineering background. I identified a lab that was doing just that, but I ended up being placed on a project to explore noise artifacts in ultrasound images, which was interesting to me. It wasn't what I wanted, but it is what led to the innovation of, you know, first I had to understand the sources of noise artifacts, which was not, it was poorly understood at the time. And so a lot of my early research was understanding why do we get acoustic clutter? We know it's there, but why? And really isolating and teasing apart the effects that cause acoustic clutter. And it was from that research and knowledge and understanding that I gained that led to thinking about, okay, now that we have a better understanding of what's causing it, what can we do to address it? And so I think that was one major turning point in, I would say, my graduate career, because now I'm starting to, based on all the knowledge that I acquired that no one else really had or studied or looked into before, now I'm starting to think about what could we do about it. And it was certainly, you know, input from my graduate mentor and advisor at the time that led to this innovation where we're all co-inventors on the technology. But it was really kind of just first understanding and then asking questions about reducing it that led to the turning point to the development of this coherence-based beamformer. And at the time, I was just working in ultrasound imaging. So I had no knowledge that it could be applicable to photoacoustic imaging because that was not even a concept to me at the time. And so I would say another turning point was, you know, realizing that because there's so much overlap in the two technology and realizing that I didn't see the poor quality in photoacoustic images initially, and questioning why is that, and then entering the field and realizing that it's there, but it's kind of swept under the rug, and then having the curiosity to say, well, if it's suffering from the same problems and the same acoustic challenges, then the same methods should work. And another turning point was recognizing that the same methods should work and then actually applying the methods and seeing them work. That was really exciting for me. And so there were many of these moments, and those are just two examples of how they came to be.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Great. Well, that is, I think, a perfect note to end this seminar on. Baisu, let me once again thank you so much for your time, and congratulations again on the Alan T. Waterman Award. And also, I want to thank our audience today, both for their attention and time, and also for the great questions that we had. So with that, I will close the lecture. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.